Hey everyone, Will Cooper here, host of Hunt Stand's Make Your Mark podcast. Join us as we dive deep into the world of hunting and outdoor pursuits. We've brought together some of the most accomplished individuals in the industry to share their invaluable insights and experiences with you. But here's the kicker. It's not just about hunting tips and tactics. We're exploring how you can carve your own path, elevate your skills, and gain some wisdom from the best in the field. So whether you're a seasoned hunter looking to fine-tune your skills or a newbie eager to learn, our podcast has something for everyone. Stay tuned for more exciting guests and hotter topics. Don't miss out and subscribe to Hunt Stand's Make Your Mark podcast today and start making your mark in the great outdoors.
Midway USA brand product designers have one straightforward goal: develop high-quality, technically sound products and deliver them to customers at reasonable prices. If you are immersed in the shooting sports industry and pay close attention to every single detail, you know our products are built right and stand up to everyday use. Who has shooting mats and range bag systems to hunting clothing and just about everything for the outdoors? Log on and shop 24/7 with super fast shipping. MidwayUSA.com.
I'm April Vokey, and you are listening to Anchored, my chance to speak with some of the most influential people involved in the outdoors today. Join me as I sit down with my guests to learn more about their careers, opinions, history, relationships, and life both indoors and out. Christine Fisher grew up fishing and playing in the outdoors. What she didn't realize at the time was that she'd soon become one of the most well-known anglers in the national kayak bass tournament scene. The recognition wasn't unwarranted. Christine boasted 3 national level wins and a second in the 2019 season, and she added another big win and several top tens in 2020. One of these wins secured her a spot on the USA team as one of 7 anglers to represent her country. It also just so happens to make her the first female in the world to ever qualify for this prestigious event. I was excited to sit down with Christine to learn more about her career and perspectives. In this episode of Anchored, we sit down to discuss her fiery online presence, her impressive catch record, and the sacrifices she's made to get this far. This episode of Anchored is brought to you by Great Fishing Adventures of Australia. The diversity of Australia's fishing experiences is as vast as the country itself. Great Fishing Adventures of Australia is the catch of Australia's best fishing operators that have come together to collectively raise the profile of Australia as a world-class fishing destination. No matter what the season, Australia offers enthusiasts the opportunity to indulge in their passion and experience some of the world's very best fishing, amongst some of the most naturally spectacular environments the world has to offer. Discover your next fishing adventure by visiting australia.com/fishing. Also, if you haven't already, be sure to check out anchoredoutdoors.com. Our trout fishing masterclass goes live next week, and it's well worth signing up for. Plus, if you sign up now, you get access to all of our classes and premium content. I love welcoming new members into our community, and I hope to get to know you better soon. Come on over to anchoredoutdoors.com or shoot me an email at info@anchoredoutdoors.com for more information. This is so exciting. I have so many questions for you.
Awesome. Yeah, I've been looking forward to this. Like I said, I followed you for a long time and have enjoyed about 98% of your shows. One of them was a little for me, but you know. I think you handled it well. It's just the guest of choice. It was interesting, thought-provoking.
I think I know that interview. And, you know, it's funny because I wasn't going to talk to you about various things that I'm sure we're going to end up talking about, but I really enjoyed going through your blog.
Which one? My old one?
I have no idea, but I was like, this girl's got a lot, or this woman's got a lot to say. Like, we'll get there. We'll get into new blogs, new thoughts, old thoughts. Right. But let's just start where we start with everybody so that we're keeping it consistent. So
perfect. Hopefully I've got a little more tact than I did about 5 years ago.
Isn't that so true? You know, I look back and I'm so embarrassed in so many ways of, you know, about my career. It's funny that, you know, you say you've been following me for a while. That means a lot to me. But at the same time, I'm like, oh God, how far back?
You have a little fiery and a little bold, but you know what? I always appreciate people that have that. And then it's interesting to see like how they how they mature with how they deliver everything. You know, it's really, I like that. I like to watch a person's career in that regard. And trust me, mine has been down that same road. So I get that.
Yeah. I wonder if we can ever grow up past it. Do you think that we're ever able to get past it? Or do you think deep down people are always like, we can't forget what we've seen?
You know, I think there probably are a lot of people that harbor those feelings, and rightfully so, but everyone to some capacity has that thing that if they're really passionate about it, yeah, it's always there within us. But I think that as we grow and as we open our minds and new perspectives and everything like that, we are able to be better about listening, entertaining other things, and just like I said, working on our deliverance. And people just have to accept it for what it is. We're allowed to change the way that we feel about something. You know what I mean? We're allowed to like change our perspectives a little bit. That's what life's all about.
Yeah, and grow up. I mean, I think it's just so easy. We all so badly want to understand other people, but it takes a serious commitment of time and dedication to understand somebody properly. So it's so easy to be like, okay, I put in the time to figure you out. I've made up my mind on who you are. And then when you have to go and figure them out again, it's like a whole new investment of time into having to figure out who they are today. So I think it's just easier to put people in a box and, right, you know, shut the lid and forget about it. So where were you born and raised?
I was born and raised in Weeping Water, Nebraska, a little town of about 800 people nestled in the southeastern part of the state. Very small, very remote, very desolate, and not a lot going on. But I had a pretty interesting and unique childhood. I was pretty fortunate to be brought into a very outdoors-oriented family with a passion for travel and camping. And, you know, like if I could sum up my childhood in just a few words, you know, the Griswold, that family Christmas movie that's awful with like everything that goes wrong. Like imagine that in a camping setting with the van, with the shag carpet and the hurricanes and like the tornadoes and the hail. That was kind of like my introduction to the outdoors with my family.
No, I really enjoy going through some of your old photos. Now, this is personal, but I ask everybody, I'm going to ask you this too. Judging by your hairstyle when you were younger, I'm going to say you're an 80s baby. Are you an 80s baby?
I am late 80s. And my dad actually did my hair. My mom worked nights. So that awful, like you see all these burns, like my parents never abused me, but my dad wasn't great with the curling iron and my mom wanted these big bangs and my dad couldn't handle it. And we did the best of what we had.
I love it. I love it. So growing up, it sounds like your parents were caring and that they did go out of their way to give you, and I think siblings, do you have siblings?
I have a younger brother. He's 2 years younger than me. So we're fairly close in age.
So it looked like they were trying to give you guys a quality life. I've read quite a bit about you not having a television, and I was hoping we could start with that because that's really interesting to me.
Yes, I'm glad you brought that up because that's something that I felt very, you know, maybe not very fortunate growing up without having one. And it wasn't necessarily, you know, we didn't have a lot of money growing up, but that wasn't the primary reason why my mom and dad didn't want us to have that. They wanted us to have, like you said, a different type of appreciation. And they wanted us to use our minds and to get outdoors and to truly experience life without the, you know, as we know, a lot of us watch TV because it's mindless. We're allowed to shut our brains off. And that's kind of the opposite of how my family functions. We're a family of entrepreneurs. We're always thinking and going 100 miles an hour. And so it just was counterintuitive to the style that my folks raised us, you know? And so it was always interesting. I was left out of a lot of those conversations, you know, in junior high and high school and what have you about, you know, what was going on with MTV or this celebrity or this TV show or, you know, these iconic shows that we all grew up with. And I felt kind of left out in that capacity. But then as soon as like, you know, I got through college and worked at a couple different jobs and heard people and how much time they invested into these series and this garbage reality TV. I remember calling my dad, and I think I was 22 years old, and it took a lot for me to do this because I'm a very proud individual, but I called him and I said, Dad, you were right. You were right. I'm sorry. I'm so glad we didn't have television, and I've never had a TV in any home that I've owned ever since then.
So what did you guys spend all your time doing? It looks like you spent a lot of time outside.
We did. That's what we did. You know, I was in a small town, but we traveled a lot. You know, my family was unique in the fact that, you know, they wanted us to have that small town upbringing, but they also wanted us to have, a little bit of culture and perspective. So we traveled a lot. Interesting enough, my mom and dad actually, before my brother was born, they wanted to live on a boat and go up and down the Mississippi River and raise us, homeschool us on a boat. I mean, how freaking cool is that? I was like, why didn't you guys do that? It's so much cooler if you guys did that. They actually bought a ton of books about it. And, you know, that's another big part of my upbringing was books. We had family nights where we go to Barnes and Noble and we were allowed to buy a book every single, you know, every 2 weeks on a Tuesday, I think it was. We'd buy a book. Gosh, we camped every weekend. I can remember my brother and I, we had that old, you know, childhood deal where you come in when the streetlights come on. It was just one of those typical small town USA upbringings with a lot of travel, a lot of crowding into the family van, going up north to Boundary Waters. Huge part of fostering my love for fishing was born on the Boundary Waters up there. I have tons of memories with that. So I was your textbook tomboy. I didn't really fit in with a lot of the girls growing up because of, I was always different, you know, in a lot of capacities actually, but that there you have it. You know, I was looking back, I could not have imagined a better upbringing. My folks did a lot of things right. And they're pretty wonderful. And I'm grateful for all of it. Cause it's why I am the way I am today and why I'm down this path. And it was pretty great.
Yeah, what were you like in high school? Because you've got this look. Let me kind of describe you for people who can't see you right now, obviously.
Hopefully not right now.
Not right. Well, you know, in general. they'll be looking you up. You can be guaranteed. You've got this Cameron Diaz look, right? Like, I'm sure you hear it all the time. You look like Cameron Diaz. You're tall like Cameron Diaz. You got the long blonde hair. You're slender. You're a Pilates instructor, I think I read. We'll talk about that later.
I was. Yeah, 5 years. My gosh. Yeah.
I mean, if you're not a head turner, I don't know what is. So in high school, were you like something about Mary or were you dorky? What were you like in high school?
So funny thing. I was very athletic. You know, I did all the sports. Definitely your textbook tomboy. It wasn't that I was not popular, but I didn't really ever fit in. I was kind of in that weird, I knew I was just kind of different than everybody. And I never really felt like I had that home of friends. You know, I didn't connect with a lot of people. I had a lot of depth to my conversation. I was searching for something different. And high school in a nutshell was just really boring for me. But I excelled in sports, loved that, very competitive. And I was that girl that, you know, the girl in high school where like, if your best friend, I had a lot of good guy friends and they wanted the cheerleaders that were high maintenance and always complaining about something. And they wanted to blow them off and go eat pizza and have a beer with me. Cause I'm like, you know, that dude with really long hair, like their sister type of thing. That was me, throughout high school. I was really close with a lot of the guys. And then, you know, 2 or 3 years later, when we got into college, they all decided that they had these feelings for me. It was a really weird deal, but I was never the girl that was sought after in that way ever. I wasn't the one that anyone wanted to date. I was the one they wanted to hang out with and call about everything and talk to on the phone for hours. But I wasn't the dateable one, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. But you know, it's funny hearing that because that sort of relationship makes it tricky. And I'll explain, I'll preface a bit. I've been there to some degree. I wouldn't say I was definitely not the tomboy that guys didn't want to, you know, get in bed. Mm-hmm. They tried, but I think in high school, once they figured out it wasn't going to happen, I was also accepted as one of the guys. And right. I don't know about if this was the same for you, but it made it really hard for me going from high school, being one of the guys to graduating, you know, going into college. Now they're not allowed to hang out with me because they're in more serious relationships. And then getting into fishing and wanting to hang with my tribe and not being accepted by the guys, it was very, very confusing for me. And it made me not desperate to be accepted, but I'd invest more time probably than I should have into trying to figure out why they wouldn't accept me. Did you have something similar happen to you?
You know, maybe a little bit. My transition was different, maybe because, you know, right out of college, every occupation I've ever held down, with the exception of Pilates, I managed a hunting department for 5 years where I was the only female company wide in hard goods. I worked hunting and fishing when I was in my early 20s for, you know, I said 5-6 years. And at first, yeah, the guys were a little hesitant, you know, like what, but I was used to that. with a lot of things. So when I joined my kayak club, the local club with 30 guys, you know, I was the girl that didn't want any help loading her kayak on the deal. I was the only girl that was competing in this local tournament. And it took a couple of days, and I did feel that weird type of maybe not pushback, but just reluctancy to let me in just yet. Well, a lot of confusion. Like, what is she doing here? Why is she here? Does she have this agenda, or is she, you know, cause you know, let's be honest, there's a lot of females in similar roles might have a different agenda with certain things. And I think guys are just, it's weird. They're not used to it. It makes them a little uncomfortable. I did experience a fair amount of that initially, but gosh, I think moving forward from there, I've been so accepted in the fishing, at least people that know me or have fished with me or have kind of heard of me, it's been fairly easy. But now, like, when I travel with a lot of the guys and do these tournaments, the women, it's been tough, you know, cause you're sharing a house with 8 or 9 guys and 3 of them are married and there's this, so that, or, you know, back home you go fishing with, I'm used to just, I had sleepovers with 5 or 6 of my guy friends in high school, you know, that strictly just great friendships, like my brothers to me. And to me, I didn't see that as anything wrong. Like, hey, I'm going to go fishing with Kevin for the day, but his girlfriend's blowing him up saying, why are you fishing with this girl? That was hard for me. And I dealt with that a lot. So I spent more time trying to make the women comfortable with me and let them know who I am than worrying about the guys. That was a very real thing for years and years and years. And I think I've got past the majority of that, but that's still kind of a holdup. Anytime you think about travel arrangements or fishing trips, you have to kind of consider how that looks and what it's perceived. And I really try to make sure the women are comfortable with it and let them get to know me and let them spend time with me. Cause that can be a whole different complex, you know?
Yeah. And I think that's one that gets just more difficult as you go. I don't think that one ever eases up. I think that one is just a downward spiral.
Right. Well, a lot of people learn.
I've got hunting and fishing buddies, with wives I'm really good friends with now, and they totally are honest with me. They're like, when you got pregnant, we did the math to see if you were on a trip with our husband at that time. And it's like, whoa, dude, seriously? You know, so, and honestly, it gets, I can't see it getting any easier as we get older and as we all get more stable and secure with our families. Like, and I wouldn't want my husband going on a fishing trip with a random woman either, regardless of how pure her intentions were. There's just so much more at risk as we get older with our families. But it's interesting because when we spoke earlier, you said, which blog were you on? And I'm curious to know which blog I was reading, because the one I was reading, it sounded like, I felt, and I could be wrong, I felt like at the time that I was reading it, that you may have been going through your own internal battles with trying to feel not accepted. I feel like that's a really lame and thirsty word, trying to be accepted. But I felt like I was reading words from a woman who had frustration with the obstacles that she was faced with. So was that the new blog or the old blog I was falling on?
That likely was the old one. Back when I guided, back when I had just gotten into, you know, the competitive fishing scene, I'd be willing to bet that that was an old blog, and you are so accurate in your observations there. I felt fiery. That's a pretty desperate word too, but I was very, there were some things, some topics that were hot topics with me. I felt like I had so much to prove. I mean, I never felt like I was the victim in anything. That's definitely not what I'm doing, but I felt like I had so many different obstacles and I had to prove all of this, and I had to rewrite this stereotype that is women, and that these women were doing a disservice to women like me, and all these other different complexes that made it really tough for me. And just felt like I was always fighting a battle that probably didn't need to be fought. If I'm looking at it, looking back now, maybe not necessarily didn't need to be fought, but not with my words, more so with my actions and just That's kind of what I've learned over the last 5 years. Look how much I've grown up. My goodness. you know, leading by example, as opposed to just attacking and fighting fires with, you know, these words. And cause I was very guilty of using my words, and I could do a lot of damage with my words, back in the day, as we all know. I was very capable of that. So I would do these long rants and these blogs and these cries for just, look, this needs to change. This is not right. This is how I feel. This is my opinion, and I'm very passionate about it. Hear me out, type of deal, you know?
Let's talk about you now, because admittedly, I wasn't going to talk to you about being a woman. I was going to I say this to every single time I interview a badass woman, I end up saying, I wasn't going to talk to you about it. And then we talk to you, each other about it, but it's just too hard to cut it out of the timeline. Mm-hmm. But I can't let it overshadow you today, because you are a tournament angler, which is really cool and something I don't know anything about. I've got questions for you. I'd like to know more about, are you fishing muskie out of a kayak?
I am. Yeah. That's one of my, that's my biggest passion. 8 or 9 years now out of the kayak with muskie. Yeah.
Is that the tournament fish that you're targeting though? Like, I was talking to Charles today and I was like, no. Oh, you should see the woman I'm interviewing today. I was like, I think she's a tournament. I was like, she's a tournament angler. He goes, oh, what does she fish for? And I was like, no, that can't be right. So what sort of fish do you tournament fish for?
Bass fishing tournaments. Okay. So essentially our tournaments are structured just like professional bass fishing, your 5 best fish over 2-3 days, however it be, you know, there's a cut, all of that. The muskie is just what I do to give myself a little, that's my breather. That's my downtime. That's my passion. That's my release. When I have a 4-day break between tournaments, I'll drive 6 hours and spend 4 days on the rivers chasing muskie, because that's how I decompress. That is my true love.
So have you tried fly fishing for them, or is it all conventional gear at this point?
I have actually, my biggest muskie to date, it was actually caught on the fly, but
no,
I have to be
way
completely transparent here. That was a 100% just act of God luck thing that I caught that fish. My casting was god awful. I mean, I had to, it was terrible. I taught myself how to fly fish, love fly fishing. It's a huge hobby, but it's one of those things that I did it because I did a lot of solo travel for years and years and years to different countries, and just to fish, and fly rods fit in a backpack, and I was a minimalist, so it just worked. But I wanted to catch a muskie on the fly. And I was with 2 friends that used to guide for yellow dog fly fishing. And we went out, broke ice to get on this tributary of the Scioto. And they should have caught that fish. Their casts were beautiful. They were launching these big meaty streamers and everything was perfect. And I'm pretty sure one of them probably got that fish close enough without us even knowing it. And then my awful, like, butchered cast that I did caught that fish, and shouldn't have. I mean, it was awesome. I mean, it was the most badass thing I've ever done. Except for the fact that I felt very underqualified for catching that fish.
Oh no, don't feel that way. Cause it could have been the fact that maybe it landed with a big slap. You know what I mean? Maybe it landed in a pile. And so it drifted
awful
first. Yeah.
Like, I can cast,
probably why it worked.
Cast little flies. Like, I've gone out solo and caught bonefish on the fly. Like, I'm working on my fly fishing stuff and I feel competent in some regard. But when you're talking about casting those giant musky streamers, I don't, no. I have a lot of work to do on that. A lot of work. And I think my rod was overpowered. I didn't have the right line. I didn't know anything going into it about that, but it was one of the coolest things I've ever done. So that was it. I caught one giant fish on a muskie on the fly.
And you've caught a lot of giant fish not on the fly. So
yes.
Let's talk about that. It's interesting. I didn't realize how many questions I had about tournament fishing until recently. We're getting ready to do our next episode of Into the Backing. It's my other podcast where we sit down and have this kind of, we pick a subject and we pick it apart. For people who are wondering where the hell that has been, I'm sorry. With COVID, it just totally threw it on everything on lockdown till we could get schedules aligned. But the next episode airs on the 1 week from now, and 1 week and a few days from now. Anyway, all of that to say, I'm trying to plan another episode on fishing for trout and just for fish in general on their beds. And the panel I was lining up was like someone who's for fishing for trout on beds, someone who's against it, and a biologist. And then it occurred to me, well, wait a second, don't bass anglers fish for bass on beds? And why is that okay? And so I started calling some bass buddy friends of mine, and I realized, holy hell, I don't know anything about tournament fishing. And I was hoping you could enlighten me because it's a totally different area that I've got no familiarity with. So maybe I could just kind of lead you through it if that's okay.
Go for it.
Okay. So with you personally, what inspired you to start tournament fishing? Was it a money thing? Like what was the, was it a challenge? What made you go, oh, okay, I'm going to totally put myself out there, be completely vulnerable and try this tournament, because that is scary. That is some super scary stuff.
You know, two things that motivated me to get into that. One, first of all, I'm kind of a rare person, the fact that I've never, honestly, to this, I've never been motivated by money. So that really had nothing to do with it going in. What really pushed me, I've always been just a natural born competitor in everything that I've done. I'm very competitive, probably to a fault almost. But the second thing is that I saw it as something that hadn't been done. And for me, I've always, I don't know, you can probably relate to this in a way, but if somebody, if there's something out there that hasn't been done, I want to be the person that can prove that it can be done. And I want to shatter these like preconceived notions that, you know, women can't compete on a professional level against the guys. And especially in a sport where there's absolutely no advantage to being a man. There's no physical advantage, there's no mental advantage, nothing. I mean, there should be no reason why we don't have professional female anglers other than the fact that they're just not doing it. And I felt like I have, you know, the tenacity, the dedication, and I like the punishment enough to put myself through that and compete. And it's something that I love to do. I love to fish. I love to compete. I love to shatter stereotypes. So it just seemed like a natural path for me.
So what was it like entering your first tournament? Tell me the whole story.
Do you want the first grassroots tournament or the actual like big national level tournament? Because they're two very different stories.
Which one was most difficult for you to make the first step with?
So the grassroots level, you know, just that'd be like your, like your dog fights, your real local stuff, where it's very low pressure, not intimidating, except for the fact that I was the only female. There were, you know, maybe 50 guys, I think, competing. I actually cashed a check. I got third. And so here I am coming. Yeah. And this, my first tournament, got third place and felt pretty awesome about that. Right. And that qualified me for a big tournament in Texas with 150 people from all over the country that qualified. And I was like, oh yeah, no big deal. I'm gonna roll in here and just do exactly what I did back home. And April, I blanked both days, zeroed both days. And I bawled my eyes out.
Oh.
I mean, bawled my eyes out. My grandparents came down. I felt like, I remember driving back from Lake Fork, Texas, feeling like I was this just pathetic excuse for an angler. And I was like, everybody knew that I blanked because they wanted to see how I would do. And there's all this pressure on me. And, you know, of course the girl was not going to catch anything in this tournament. And I just put all this unnecessary pressure on myself. And I literally zeroed at my first big tournament. This was 5 years ago, I believe. And it, for the first 6 hours of the drive, it was a 10-hour excruciating drive back home with this defeat, right? And the first few hours, I was like, I'm never fishing again. I'm selling all my gear. I'm done. Like, this is it. I'm not doing it. We all go through this battle, right? And then by the end of the drive, yeah, I'm sitting there telling myself, I'm going to go back and I'm going to absolutely dominate this scene. I don't care what it takes. I don't care if I lose sleep, if I spend all my money, invest all my time. I'm channeling everything I've got and I'm going to put it into this. And so that's what I did.
And then what happened, Cinderella? Because from what I've seen, it looks like you've been cleaning up out there. So like, what was the next step in your tournament career?
So the year after that, I continued to kind of dabble. I still lived in Nebraska, but I would fly out and fish these tournaments, and I ended up having some success. I had a fourth place out of 100 in Gunnersville. I had a sixth place on Erie. You know, I had several top tens, and I was starting to kind of solidify a little bit of consistency on the national level. And I said, okay, you know what? This is really cool. I think that I had an opportunity to kind of go on the road and do it full time. And I did that. And that year I went on the road full time. I invested 115% of my energy to fishing these tournaments. And the year prior, there's a big Bass Open on Kentucky Lake, usually has 130 people. And this is a very prestigious tournament because the winner of that tournament, actually how it was structured, the two people that first and second place qualified for what they call Hobie Worlds. And that is a very prestigious international competition, very difficult to qualify for. The U.S. sends, I think, six people, and first and second at this tournament go. And it's the best competition all over the country. And that first year, I was kind of flying out and fishing random things or driving. I got third, and I thought I had second. And it shattered me. I mean, I was 126 people. I got third, which I should have been really happy with, mm-hmm. right? My first year really competing nationally, but I wasn't. I was devastated. So this would have been last year was my first year on the road full-time fishing this tournament, and I won that tournament last year. My first big national win. I was the first female to ever legitimately qualify for Hobie Worlds. It like changed my life. And I went on to win two more big tournaments that last year. Like I won three. I had a second place. I had a third place. I had an incredibly, I guess from the outside looking in, I was incredibly successful tournament-wise, but it came at a price. When I really focus on a goal, I almost disregard every other aspect of my life, taking care of myself personally, physically, taking care of my family or anything else. I focused everything I had, and I was incredibly successful at that. But I just recently posted about that balance, and I had to really reflect on that and say, look, though I was successful and I accomplished my goals, you know, I qualified Hobie Worlds, I won three big tournaments, I cashed 15 checks last year. And I'm really making a name for myself as this competitive angler that is holding her own with the best in the game on this deal. But man, I gave everything to make that happen. And it was kind of an interesting self-reflection that I had to do when COVID hit, and I had time to actually look back and look at kind of the wake of that success and what it meant. So that's kind of, and here we are now.
Yeah. Do you ever sit back and, well, see, it's hard because I was going to ask you, do you ever sit back and wonder what's the point of it all? Why am I giving myself to all of this? But at the same time, if you're cashing checks, it's like going to work every day. So, I mean, am I looking at it wrong? Cause like for me, I had to take a step back and be like, okay, yeah, I'm a trout bum. Woohoo. I'm hardcore. Yeah. Respect me. I respect myself. Look at how many fish I catch.
And then
I was like, why though? But I'm lonely. I'm totally miserable.
That is the question right there. And that's exactly what I had to ask myself. You know, what am I doing this for? Honestly, you know, why? For me, it's interesting because I think that all of us to some degree, whether we are, you know, CEO of some company or we own a coffee shop or we're a bartender or whatnot, we all strive for this purpose in life, right? I mean, that's a really important aspect of why we're here. And we all want to feel this sense of purpose that we're making a difference. And when I look at what I'm doing, and I still am in the middle of this journey right now and trying to understand, is it worth it? You know, is everything that I'm doing for what? Am I really going to make a difference on a large enough scale to where I can look back 20 years from now and say that was worth it? My sacrifices, my time, everything that has happened, is it worth it? I mean, at the end of the day, April, it's just fishing, right? It's really just fishing.
It is, but we also spend so many hours at work. I mean, I guess the big question that I have for you is your tournament angling at this point paying all your bills? Like, do you have another job or is this your full-time job?
Thankfully I don't have to rely on tournament winnings to I count that as a bonus. You know, sponsorships and mostly just sponsorships. And I've been a freelance writer for 8 or 9 years and I pick up some odd and end jobs here and there with writing. But no, my sponsorships pretty much pay my bills.
Right. So your job is basically going fishing. So,
yeah.
So many of us, I can't speak for myself here, but I've heard that a lot of people have been really miserable and wondering about their purpose in life because they go to their office job 9 to 5 and they're miserable working for somebody else under fluorescent lights. And so it's really amazing to think of, you know, people like us who are really fortunate to be able to forge a career outdoors. And yes, there are sacrifices and there are always difficulties and hardships and all of those sorts of things. But I guess the big question here is, what do you feel like you're sacrificing?
So I guess for the most part would be, you know, family.
I didn't want to be the one to say it. I was like,
I was waiting for that to come. And I was like, okay, I better do this. But I mean, like a family, and that's not meant to say that we all have different paths and goals and purposes and on this earth. And maybe that is not meant for me, but you know, I've never been the girl when I was young. I never dreamed about Prince Charming or having kids. That was never really something that I felt a yearning for. And I thought that maybe one day I'd wake up and say, gosh, I want to be a mom tomorrow. But I've never really had that innate yearning to be a mom or do any of that. But at the same time, I think because I'm just wired very differently, it maybe just hasn't occurred to me yet that I might at some point want that, or will I regret it? And I've had a lot of really interesting conversations with women that both who have kids and both who don't. Mm-hmm. Really compelling conversations late night. I mean, sitting cross-legged on floors, drinking coffee and just diving into this topic, because it's fascinating to see these women and the choices they've made and how they feel about it. And I think that for me, I haven't really decided what it is that I want in that capacity, but I do want to share this life with somebody at some point. I think we're not meant to be alone. And this life that I'm doing, I'm not very easy to be with. I'm on the go 100% of the time. I have very different goals and objectives and everything than what I'm doing. And I look at that and I'm like, I'm doing all of this. I'm trying to pave the way for female anglers and do all these things and conquer these mountains, yada, yada, yada. But where does that leave me when I'm 45, you know, 40? 35, wherever, where is that going to be? Is this mission, or is this really what I'm meant to be doing? Because at the end of the day, I want to make a difference. I want to change people's lives. I want to inspire them to truly fulfill what it is they're supposed to do and to live out their purpose. I'm a huge, huge believer in that. But what is my purpose? Is it meant to be fishing and breaking down these stereotypes and doing all this and sacrificing all this? I'm not sure. I wish I could tell you.
But. And you won't for a while. You're in your early 30s, right?
Yeah, I'm 32, freshly 32, kind of. Mm-hmm. I'll be 33 very soon, actually.
That was a big, those few years, personally, for me anyway, those few years were huge. That was when it all happened. Mm-hmm. I started wondering.
You can either go this way or you can go this way. Mm-hmm. There's a fork and I'm approaching it. I'm not there, but I'm slowly encroaching upon this fork in the road. And I know that I've got some life altering decisions to make.
But there's also this exhaustion that sets in too, where you're like, okay, you know, you said it yourself, you're trying to forge a path for women. And there are times when, especially when you get abused online or you see the industry heading in this, or just society heading down this path, that you're like, wait, what? No, haven't you all learned
it's
from
that? Right. It's like, everything I'm doing, is this in vain? Is everything I'm doing in vain?
Yes.
And that's like, that's infuriating.
And a lot of the time you will bash your head against the wall. And a lot of the time it is in vain. And unfortunately, there just comes a time when you just see it clearly for what it is. And you're like, now what am I supposed to do? And you start questioning yourself. Like, it's really funny. You know, I'm going to be totally open and put it out there. And only because, like, I feel like I've known you for a long time, even though we don't, you know, just met. But I think I'm one of the most overrated anglers in history. And it's funny because, you know, we talk about this all the time, because I'll have, like, we went fishing not that long ago in the Snowy Mountains, and I couldn't for the life of me get my line where I needed it to go. Turns out there's a whole lot of reasons why. It was a two weight. My husband had lined the rod. Everything wasn't lined properly. But I had this moment where I looked at him and he shook his head quietly and he walked away. And of course, you know, I turned around and, what's that for? And he's like, just nothing. And he's like, you know, you're a professional. You should be able to make that cast. And I just saw red, and not because he was wrong, but because he was right. And I was like, okay, what do you want me to say? That I'm overrated? And as I was spewing this vomit, I realized what it was coming out of my mouth. And what I was saying is, everybody else has hyped me up. I haven't hyped myself up. And then I had to take a big step back and go, well, have I? Is this my fault? Anyway, I could go on a whole tangent on this and we could break it down after I kind of make my point here. But my point is, one day it all hits you in the face and it makes you look at yourself with more scrutiny than you ever thought that you possibly could. And it just makes you question your last 20 years. It makes you question your steps moving forward. It makes you question your value, your worth, your skill, your decisions. It literally makes you tear yourself apart. And it's a really hard time in your life when you look at yourself through that lens, if that makes sense. Coming up, Christine and I continue our conversation. Again, thank you to Great Fishing Adventures of Australia for making this episode possible. If you're planning a visit to Australia, I cannot emphasize enough that you check out australia.com/fishing. When I followed my husband down here, I couldn't believe the opportunity I was witnessing. Huge fish, experienced guides, countless species. Australia is home to some of the most diverse quality fisheries on our planet. Great Fishing Adventures of Australia brings together some of Australia's best fishing operators to collectively raise the profile of Australia as a world-class fishing destination. Learn more by visiting australia.com/fishing.
Like, and you said, when we have to look at ourselves through that lens, I hope that when that time comes for me, that I have the tools necessary to deal with it in the right way. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Because for a long time, women especially it's happening. I don't know if you saw the Swarovski post, attacking the influencer that they just partnered with, but women right now are under a microscope and maybe rightfully so. Like, you know, people want some sort of, credibility when it comes to people representing these companies that have had a really good reputation and haven't really had to utilize social media up until this point. But I've tried really hard in all that I do to earn everything that's come my way in every capacity. And I still, to this day, I get people that make comments. I've had several over the years that are accusing me of cheating at these tournaments or... Even that's been a hard one for me. I mean, mm-hmm. I go pro every tournament and it's not because I want to make a YouTube video. It's to save my own tail and to say, look, here's the GoPro of every fish I've caught, of every decision I make. I talk out loud about why I'm switching to this bait because this condition is changing or the barometric pressure just dropped and I know these fish are going to move up on this bar and feed. I detail everything so people know and understand that this is me doing what I'm doing. No one's catching the fish for me. No one's making decisions for me. I'm out there by myself. I pre-fish, I break down maps and all of this. And for what? You know, no matter what I feel like I do, I'm under a microscope. It's awful, you know? And that's something that'll never change.
No, and that actually brings me to the crux of and to my whole point of that rant that I just kind of mindlessly threw out there. You are in this really cool situation where, well, I guess I'll ask you. I don't want to assume you're in a situation. See, for me, I have to look at myself and be like, am I overrated? Maybe. Am I the best steelheader? No. Am I the best caster? No. Am I the best fly tire? No. Am I a good businesswoman? Yeah. Have I been a good pioneer for this? Yes. So am I overrated? Sure. In many ways. And am I overrated in a lot of other ways? Nope. But with you, do you ever even question if you're overrated? Because like if someone were to say that, you could laugh because you're a tournament angler. Like does that part of any sort of insecurity or questioning even exist for you being a tournament angler?
You know, maybe not, because my tournament, I mean, you can't really fake tournament success. And that's maybe a reason why I did it, because before I started tournament fishing, obviously, I fished my entire life. I started Instagram. I put these pictures, these giant pike and muskie up, and people, I get those comments saying, well, she caught them. Someone caught them for her. You know, she didn't really catch that. a guy took her out. She's on a guide trip. And rightfully so. A lot, that happens a lot. So I don't fault people for initially thinking that, but I was like, okay, look, I'm going to show you all. I'm going to go out there. I'm going to fish tournaments, because then what can you do? If I succeed, why? Like, you can't take that away from me. And so I did that, and I started fishing tournaments. And I guess when it comes to being overrated, I mean, I'm not on the, there's never been a professional, a true professional female angler. I mean, one that has qualified for the elites or MLF, the two big professional entities out there when it comes to bass fishing. There's never been one that's been good enough to make that circuit. So when people, I do feel overrated when I get, you know, people commenting after I win a tournament on the national kayak scene, which there are a lot of ex-boaters and tournament FLW guys that fish the kayak circuit. And we've had a couple pros, Mike Iaconelli and Jordan Lee have fished the kayak tournaments, and it's been great for our sport. But when there's people that comment on there, oh, you could make the elites, you know, if you just got to fish the opens, you'd qualify. I'm like, no, that's not how that would go. I'd probably fish the opens and get my freaking tail kicked for 3 or 4 years. And then I think that after that, I think I do have what it takes to eventually get there, but I'm not just going to come out and take money from the best 80 guys in the world. Like, that's not how that's going to go at all.
It would be so yeah, nice though. It would be awesome.
That would be great. Don't get me wrong. I would love that to go like that, but that's not realistic. I feel very competent in my angling abilities, but at the same time, going up against the 80 professional men out there that have grown up with a flipping stick in their hand since they were 2 and do this for a living and are doing this to feed their families. No, I don't think that tomorrow I could go out there in a bass boat that I haven't spent any time in and kick their tail. That's not how that would go. But you know, I feel overrated in that capacity, for sure.
But you're not overrated. That's the key here. And I've never read anything about you being overrated. And I've never read anything about an angler, man or woman, who does well in tournaments as being overrated. But for some reason, I'm constantly seeing people like myself who, and hundreds of other anglers who do this professionally, constantly be called overrated. So where do we draw the line? Like, what does that mean? And obviously it's a sensitive subject for me, being overrated, even though it's true in a lot of ways. So what does that mean though? Like, where do you draw the line on being overrated? Does that mean that we're truly only worth the recognition that we receive if we are catching more fish than anyone else? Like, where's the line there?
That is the conversation that I love to have. And I think it's really interesting. And obviously there are going to be opinions all over the spectrum on this, right? But I think that because it's not fair to people like you that have put the time and have built themselves on a very solid foundation and have a very credible reputation. But you have to understand that in the industry that we're in right now, it is flooded, absolutely flooded and inundated with a lot of, gosh, what is a better word than posers? There's got to be a better word than that. My brain is fogged, but you know what I mean. They're everywhere. And you go to shows like ICAST and TSA and all this stuff, and you're just like, wow, this is in SHOT Show. You're just like, my goodness, this is like reality fishing and hunting. And this is not the outdoors. So you get these people, you get these guys and maybe gals that are just tired of it. They're done. They're upset because these women that have spent 2 days in the outdoors are getting these opportunities and sponsorships that they feel entitled to because they put the time in. They know about X-Ship on Shimano reels, but they just sponsored a gal that couldn't tell you what a Metanium is or a Bantam is. You know, it's like, so there are people that are just angry out there. And so then they're looking at that and they see that they're using that and seeing that any female with this opportunity or this platform, well, how did she get there? If this 90% of the industry got there based on their looks or because they're just solely because they're a female, well, they just lump all of us into this general term. And I think that we all get kind of lost in that a little bit, which is not how it should be by any means. But then where do we draw the line? What constitutes and what's the criteria?
Well, that's what I would like to know. Like, what makes somebody not overrated then? I mean, is it that they've genuinely put in their time? Does that make them not overrated? I mean, one of my favorite exchanges is listening to the guy, let's be honest, the guys bitching about it online. They're like, yeah, but she guided on this river and that river. And then when that wasn't enough, they were like, oh, but that river's so easy. I mean, there's so many still out there. So it's like, where? and
what the criteria should be is transparency and being real. Just being real. That is such a thing that I think that we're missing in every aspect of what we're doing, especially on social media, because people want to put this front out there. And some of the most impactful people that I've ever met in my life, one of my roommates is one of them, is very new to fishing and fishes tournaments and hasn't maybe had a lot of success in the tournament field, but she documents all of it and she's real. She's a beginner and it's so relatable and it's so just raw and incredible because it's real. So I think that would be just originality, just genuine, real, transparent. Look, if a gal came out there and said, I'm a terrible bass fisherman, but I freaking love it. I like getting up at sleeping until 9, getting out there. And I like when these fish blow up on this big thing that I've got out there. It's awesome. Like, love it. Not the best at it, learning, maybe just being real. Maybe that's what people are craving. But it's when you have a gal out there that's painted like this professional backcountry sheep hunter and she's never been in the mountain, that type of thing, I think infuriates people and they're getting tired of it and they don't want to see it. They want somebody that's real. Especially when you're representing a brand, like a high-end product, wouldn't you expect, like, look at the males, look at male, what it takes to be a male professional in our sport. Right? You're teaching seminars. You are either cashing checks, fishing tournaments on a high level, teaching seminars competently about the product, doing videos. How many females could do what the male pros can do realistically, exactly like they do? And yeah,
if there were as many of them out there doing it as the guys, I would suspect it would be a pretty even number. But because the reality is there aren't as many women out there doing it, they're just... I guess the answer to your question is not very many could be doing it in the way that they're doing it, considering the numbers and the statistics. May I ask you something?
Absolutely.
Be totally brutally honest. How much of this is the media's fault? And I lump myself in media, by the way. How much of this is our fault? I read an article, and I won't throw anyone under the bus too far, but I'd read an article from a mainstream hunting fishing media source recently, and they were celebrating a female bass angler who had won, made a big win. I can't remember who it was. And I didn't read the original article, but apparently it was so bad. They mentioned about her boobs in the first few sentences, and they had to write an apology letter. And my point is, if a media outlet of that size and that reputation is celebrating a win and making comments and drawing attention to the fact that it's a woman, or you and I are sitting here right now, technically media, talking about being a woman, how much of this is our fault? Because then other women are watching all of this and seeing the attention and they're like, oh, well, that encourages me to go out and do something, because clearly there's a market for it. Every time that people talk about it, it's the sole focus.
Right. Honestly, I'm going to be 100% honest with you on this, April. I think that it is 95, if not more, percent the media's fault. You can't blame the women for seeing a flaw in our system and taking advantage of it. You really can't blame them. That's human nature.
Well, and it's being a businesswoman, right? And I think that that's a trend that we're seeing, is a lot of these people who are being sponsored. Yes, we all huff and puff and try to blow the house down, but at the end of the day,
yeah, it's easy. It is so ridiculously easy right now to be a female in the outdoors. And as much as, like, it's unfortunate, it is what it is, and you can't fault them for that. Who you have to look at are the companies, or is the media, and what they're portraying and how they're portraying it and how they are marketing it. You really cannot fault the women here.
But then it swings, right? It's like television. I remember for a while there, I was going back and forth with a big television network, and it was like, and this went on for like 12 years. And one year they'd be like, oh, April, we're focusing all of our efforts on strong females this year. And then the next year they're like, ah, the trends are changing. We need to have less empowered females and more of this and more of that. Or this year we're focusing on guns. Like, every year's got a trend. So it's almost like this big pendulum where it's easy for women, and then it swings the other way. And I've been there on that swing where they're like, we want to sponsor you. We can't sponsor you because people will just assume it's because you're a woman. We're really sorry. We're going to have to wait until, the trend changes. So it's like this big, huge swinging.
Who was in control of these trends? I always wondered that. I've wore the same clothes since I was like 5 years old. I like flannel and, very outdoorsy oriented clothes. And there was a time where I remember flannel was in and then it wasn't. And then all of a sudden it was. And my, you know, people would come up and say, oh, I love your shirt. And I got that like every 9 years. I was like, oh, I'm trending again. But who, like, how does that happen? Like, who are we? Who controls these trends? Like, what is that? I've never really, that's one thing I've never understood. And I like to know a little bit about everything out there. And that's one thing that I've never been able to put the puzzle pieces together with.
I can't speak on behalf of fashion, but I've got a pretty decent idea, in my opinion anyway, on the sort of, whether it's a strong woman this year or a more passive woman this year. And it feels like so much of it is politics, right?
Yeah.
And again, I'm just a little Canadian Australian watching American politics from afar. And I love listening to Ben Shapiro, even though I don't agree with everything he says, but I do enjoy listening to him. And you know, it's interesting to hear just how it swung from like Me Too, even being so strong and empowered, to now we're in a stage where people are, experts are genuinely concerned that men are going to be suffering the most with a lot of these, you know, quote unquote trends. So I would say politics, but I'd be definitely waiting and over my head if I tried to delve into it any deeper than that.
No, I think if you're, that's a, it's a pretty sound observation for sure. If you look at it and how, cause right now I know I've felt it personally that women are, and so, you know, women and, minorities, I'll go and put that out there. They want diversity in the outdoors more now than ever. And that's probably definitely because of political, you know, recent political things. So that's, you're probably spot on with that.
I mean, it'll always come down to money, right? It doesn't matter if it's political, it's always going to come down to money. Right. And that is something that I feel comfortable speaking about. But so I think that's what it comes down to, is they just want as many people as possible in, because that means more money. Mm-hmm. And as far as companies go, and I found myself in a similar situation recently with my company, with Anchored Outdoors, which is my new company. And it's my first company that's not focused around myself. And in looking at marketing and looking at numbers and looking at reach and all of those things that we sit and look at that keep us up at night as business owners, it is impossible for me to not look at influencers. And when I look at taking on an influencer, it's really hard. It's very tempting as an influencer to look at somebody who's got a high following, who isn't against anything that I'm against. But I know deep down why they're being sponsored, right?
Right.
As a business owner, it's hard to walk away from that, especially if they're like, I believe in your product and I want to support you. And you know that they can, and you know that they're not really doing any damage. Ooh. I don't know. I get it, but it always comes down to money.
That's a tightrope.
So I notice that we follow some of the same troll accounts.
Oh, I know where you're going with this.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a big part of me that feels guilty for adding to their audience, and an even bigger part of me that feels guiltier for wasting my time reading that stuff. But at the end of the day, it's interesting because it helps me keep my finger on the pulse with what's going on out there.
Right.
And with the trends, what are your thoughts on these whole troll accounts?
I know the two that you're probably referring to, and that, yeah, it's like we indulge in it because it is this entertainment, and you know, some of it you it's like a train wreck you can't turn away from. And at times there are some very valid points that I agree with that they're making, but with a lot of flair, a lot of unnecessary flair probably. And I think that that's a really tough one, because a lot of people call them, you know, the heroes, you know, that the industry needs, you know, that they're wearing this cape, and they've definitely, there's a base there. But at the end of the day, what good does it do? And when I say that, yes, I agree with them that a lot of the stuff, especially when they bring up the you know, the poaching and this illegal, you know, killing, mishandling of fish or whatever it may be, 100% on board with that. But the other stuff, does it discourage newcomers into the sport, and women primarily, you know, that look at this and say, gosh, I don't know what I'm doing. So if I do this and take a picture, are they going to make fun of me and ruin my life and harass me in this way? So I've tried to take a step back from all of it and just look at these troll accounts and really try to look at it from every single perspective that I can, because you know my background, you know how I feel, and I'm very passionate about, especially the women fishing and having these credible anglers that you know, that we can get behind that are the face of women fishing and whatnot. But also, we want to be welcoming and opening to newcomers in our sport. And gosh, I'm kind of going down a rabbit hole here, and I'm not getting my thoughts organized very well. It's really hard. That's a very tough topic. Are they necessary? Do they do good? Do they do more bad? Are they bringing... It is probably toxic to a degree, right?
I think that they help control the trends. Do I think they're toxic to a degree? Yeah, of course. But I also think that they contribute to the trends. You know, I know,
right?
I've heard from several businesses in the fishing industry who have been like, look, I got to be honest, before I go and do something with my company, I do think to myself, if I do this, is it going to flare up on a troll account? And same with myself. I've had a couple influencers where I've been really tempted. And then I've thought, I don't know if it's worth having to deal with it, with the silent majority and, you know, reading about it later on a troll account.
Right.
So I'm very curious. And I totally admit I learned about you through one of those troll accounts.
Yeah. So actually both of them, I've conversed with both of them numerous times over the years, and I'm thankful to have their respect, and I support a lot of what it is that they do. And I think that they have good intentions in what they're doing. Maybe some of the posts I don't 100% agree with. I can think of a few over the years that I'm just like, man, that might be a little much, or there's probably a little better way. And they probably agree with that too. But now the recent one where they brought up the Swarovski deal, that was necessary. They really received some pushback. And I think that from what I've heard, their marketing team is trying to, you know, try to come back from that and not maybe do that ever again. And that without that account posting it, it probably would not have had the level of pushback that it did. And I think that's important for companies to see that. Like, look, to have a vetting process. You've got to make sure they fit the culture that is the picture you're trying to paint, right?
That's the key word right there, right? Staying within brand, right? If you've built your brand on...
Yeah, staying within brand. Mm-hmm,
that makes perfect sense. Speaking of staying within brand, I've got questions for you about tournaments, if that's okay.
Certainly.
How would somebody who's listening to this right now, who really just wants to compete, not against other people, but they want to do it for themselves, or maybe they look at themselves and question if they're overrated and to them within themselves, and they want to give themselves that little bit of self-validation. What would the first step be?
Honestly, I think the first most important thing is we can't compare ourselves to anybody else out there. You can't compare yourself to me. You can't compare yourself to the best angler out there. You have to look at yourself. And if you've got a goal, if you're something you want to do, let all of it, we get so guilty of listening to all these outside voices telling us who we should be, who we are, you know, who we're not. Listen to yourself, listen to that inner voice, and just go do it. If that's what you want to do and that you're going to find some self-love in that, absolutely do it. Fear is very binding, and listening to everybody else and what they think you should do is very binding. And I think that the best thing you can do, self-worth is really tough for a lot of us. And I think a lot of people battle with that. And I think that for me personally, getting out there on my own and fishing these tournaments and having the camaraderie that I found in this sport was one of the best decisions I could have ever made. It's not an easy route, but nothing good ever comes easy in this, in life, in anything. So if it's something that potentially scares you or that is going to be difficult, I'm all for doing it. That's why I musky fish, because no one in their right freaking mind would spend time musky fishing, but the reward is there. And it's like, if it's this painful, emotional battle, do it, because there's growth there and it's beautiful and it's wonderful, and just do it.
So you pay your fee, you go out, you try to catch fish. You obviously have to prove you've caught a certain amount of fish. And then what happens? You come back and do they hang it on a board? Like, can you just blank out and very quietly hang your head and walk away without anyone knowing?
Yeah.
Like, what's the presentation of it all?
Okay. So that's what's really cool about kayak fishing. With the boat side of it, obviously, with the exception of MLF, when they do a catch weigh release, it's all live in that. The boat world, you know, you have your live well, and so you bring your bag in, you weigh it, and if you don't have a bag, obviously it's humiliating, right? So kayak fishing is a little bit less intimidating, and it's very welcoming, and it's a little less cutthroat than the boating world. So
what do you mean by you bring your bag in?
Because so that's very confusing. On the boating side of it, like, you've got your Bassmaster Elites, you know, arguably the most prestigious trail out there in the professional is Bassmaster. And you see the Bassmaster Classic they have every year, and they drive the boats in. The anglers bring they have a large bag that has the oxygen in the water, and they've got it's your best five fish each day. And you bring your bag in and you weigh it, and they hold their big fish up for the crowd. Everyone cheers and they go back. And, you know, if you don't have a bag, you kind of walk up and you're like, I had a tough day out there. Nothing.
Wait. So they're dead. They're dead.
No, they have to be alive. If they're dead, you're penalized.
So is the bag full of water?
Yep. It's water with oxygen tablets in it. So it keeps the fish alive. Yeah. Now for kayak though, we do catch photo release. So we have a very innovative app that we use. We have a pre-certified measuring board with a unique identifier and an app that has our timestamp, GPS, all of that. So there's no way that we can, you know, not do anything right. And we have the certified measuring board that has the sticker on it that we get the day before the tournament. And we put the fish on there and we do it by length, and it's our best five. And then we submit that fish to an app. And then that total does our total inches. So yeah, people can go in and look and see, oh, how'd they finish? They got 0 inches. They blanked. Or they've got 95. That's great. You know, they just follow you from there. And the kayak fishing is great though, because it's great for our sport. It is catch photo release right away. You don't have to, the overhead's not there. You don't have to buy a boat. You don't have to get up there against these people and pay these huge entry fees. And to be honest with you, April, kayak fishing now, if you look at another like smaller league or like the BFLs, our tournaments pay out better than those do. You know, we fish for tournaments that pay out 30 grand for first, you know, or 10 grand for first, or 6 grand for the smaller ones. I mean, it's not, they're with relatively low overhead. And the best thing about our sports, the community, we're all, it seems like this kayak fishing family was built from these minimalistist people that love to get outdoors and just are passionate about helping others, teaching them about the sport. So I'd encourage any people out there that are curious about tournament fishing, get into the kayak world. I've gained a family in this whole deal. I feel like I've got, you know, 100 new grandpas and 500 fathers and these 1,000 big brothers in these 50 states that I travel to, that we're just a giant family. And it's a really unique thing, because the bass boat side sometimes are painted in this very cutthroat, stab you in the back to get this and get all this money type of deal. Or kayak fishing, we're like, nah, man, like, let's have a campfire and have a couple beers and hopefully we catch them tomorrow type of deal. You know, we're still very competitive, but it's way more welcoming and a little less intimidating, I think.
I get that vibe. I look at a lot of the stuff Hobie does and I get that vibe. It seems just a little more chill. Did I see that you caught a sailfish in a kayak?
I did. Yeah, I did.
What?
Yeah, about 5-6 years ago. I'm a trophy hunter. I love catching fish that are, you know, bigger than me or what have you. I love that. So yeah, I caught a sailfish in the kayak down in Florida off Delray Beach, and it was awesome. That was a cool deal.
But aren't you terrified? Like, I would love to start kayak fishing here in Australia, and I'm terrified that a tiger shark is going to be like,
way different deal. Your great whites are on steroids down there. I'm not sure I would kayak fish in Australia. Let's be honest. So yeah, I would caution you on that probably.
Okay, good. I will heed your advice. Now, what about this whole bass on beds thing? I'm very confused by it. I had read that that guy got busted fishing for bass on beds, but I thought that tournament anglers fished for bass on beds. Can you help me understand this?
Absolutely. So it is a strategy. It's completely legal in tournaments. And I'm not a fan of bed fishing, just strictly because it's an entirely different way to fish. But, you know, as you know, depending on where you're in the country, bass will spawn in the early spring or down in January if you're in Florida. And essentially, the controversy is, if you're looking at it, at least from the bass standpoint, you pull a fish off the bed, you're messing up a little bit of that process there. And if you're fishing for smallmouth on beds, a lot of the lakes up north have the goby, and you pull them off their bed, put them in a live well, drive them across the lake, and the goby come in and eat the eggs. So there's been a lot of research and underwater footage and stuff trying to done to paint bed fishing in a better light. And depending on what the ecosystem is and how that all kind of sets up, there's a lot of different opinions on it, as you well know. But it's perfectly legal in tournament, and it's a strategy. I typically try to target pre or post spawners because I'm going to be honest with you, I am not a great bed fisherman. I didn't grow up down south to where you have the ability to see fish on beds. You know, Nebraska, we've got, you know, the muddy farm pond waters, and we could never see fish bedding. It was very rare. So I didn't have a lot of practice doing that. But what I can do is catch post and pre-spawners very well. I know where they set up and where they're staging, and I understand that process. I fish for fish on a bed, but again, it's just not something that I like to waste a lot of time doing, but it's perfectly legal in all the tournaments. You see a 10 pounder sitting there, guys will waste 5 hours trying to catch that fish.
So why did that guy get crucified? What did he do wrong that was so devastating to his career?
Was that Mike Long, the California guy?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
He was snagging them.
Oh, okay. Well, that's different.
Yeah totally different.
Okay, got it. Say no more.
Snagging them and acting like, yeah, it's like the Batman thing when you have the guy Joker there, and he's like, we can't tell the people that the Joker's a Joker because it would ruin. He was painted as this like heroic figure for Gotham City. It was like that. It like ruined everybody. Almost wish that never would have came out because all these kids looked up to him and idolized him, and then he comes out as this fraud, and it just is devastating to our community. But that's part of it.
Ouch.
Yeah, it was terrible. What people do for fame, right?
Well, what are your thoughts on this? In the trout and salmon world, it's highly frowned upon. As, for me, it's illegal. Like in Canada, in a lot of places in Canada, it's just illegal. So it's a non-issue. But in certain places in Colorado and other states, it's not illegal. Yet if somebody is busted doing it, they're immediately, you know, quote unquote, canceled. They're like the next Mike Long. Yeah, so
blackballed, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on that? And I ask selfishly because when we do this Into the Backing episode, I'm really battling with myself on whether or not to even include a bass angler in the conversation because I don't know if it's relevant. I mean, do you think that they're part and parcel, that they're similar enough to put together at the same table?
You know, my trout knowledge is nothing compared to what my bass knowledge is, but I do know that my knowledge of trout people is fairly good. I have a lot of guys. I know a lot of that culture, and you know, I mean, your trout fishermen, man, they are. They're purists, right, in every regard, and you better be doing everything right. That fish better be in the water at all times. You better not even lift it up out of the water. It better have all the slime on it, and you better not be in the picture. And you can't do a grip and grin. And there's all these rules, like unwritten rules in trout fishing that I've learned. And I'm like, gosh, man, it's an interesting community for sure. But I respect that. I've got respect for it, right? So that doesn't surprise me at all that there is a lot of backlash with fishing for trout on beds. It doesn't surprise me at all. But your bass guys probably are not the guys to ask about that because they're not going to give you the answers probably that you want to hear.
Yeah. Yeah. I think I'll wait to hear the response from people when they listen to the episode. And if there's a huge demand for it and people are like, no, damn it, April, do another one. We want to hear a bass guy and or gal and their opinion, then we'll do it another one. What about catch and release when it comes to properly holding bass? That's something that I admittedly am a little bit confused about because I always thought you lipped them. And then I remember them saying, okay, support their belly. But then I would do that and they'd be like, no, you're holding it too hard around the heart. Like what is the proper way to handle a bass, especially for somebody who is tournament fishing and doing catch and release angling?
So that's going to greatly depend on who you ask. Now, I always try to follow the general guideline that if you have a large fish, regardless of the species, and I try really hard to educate myself on every species. I don't want to be someone that goes out there and doesn't know what they're doing and is disrespecting our resources in any regard. So with bass, you see, obviously, with large fish, I always think no matter what the species, it's just customary and proper to, you know, lipping bass is fine. And I always try to support the belly and do that more of a vertical hold there. But you see, again, the Bassmaster Elites, they take their two fish and they're holding them up just like that. And that's what we see as bass fishing. And a lot of the research that I've personally done, there's not enough out there that says that it is detrimental to their health if they are for a few seconds held up, vertically like that. even though when I try to do most of my stuff with larger, you know, your double digit bass plus, I try to do that horizontal supporting the belly. But I think that's more important when you're getting into your ESOC species, your larger game fish like that. But like I said, you've got the face of bass fishing doing those vertical holds and all of their tournaments, and those fish are released and they swim off fine. And I just haven't seen enough negative research that states otherwise. So with bass, they're pretty hardy. You know, same general rule of thumb, don't keep the fish out of the water for an unrealistic amount of time. I think with any species, keeping the fish in the water is huge. That's probably the best thing we can do as anglers is, you know, we've got this thing where we want to take this great picture, but keep the fish in the net in the water, get everything set up, fish lift up, few seconds, fish goes back in, releases, good. I think that practicing that is probably the best way to do it. And with trout, you know, obviously it's never lift them up and do a grip and grin because that's frowned upon. So
you said something there a second ago that was very interesting to me. You said the face of bass fishing tournaments. And to me, the first thing I think of is like a bunch of NASCAR looking driver looking guys standing around hoisting trophies and fish up in the air. Do you think, or have you seen that image starting to change? Or do you think it's one of those things where it will just forever be, that's the face it will forever be?
That's a good question. I think like you mentioned with trends, people are trying to paint a more diverse picture of bass fishing, and it looks, cause it looks different to everybody. And realistically, April, tournament fishing makes up such a tiny percentage of what actually represents the fishing industry, right? Very small, very, very, very small. Even in kayak fishing, the amount of kayak tournament anglers compared to the amount of kayak wreck anglers is bar none. I mean, it's maybe 20% tournament anglers. The majority are just recreational anglers that like to get out when they get off of work at 5 o'clock and, you know, cast the bank for a few hours. So that's a great question. I think that how we see it in the magazines and, you know, what we look up to, it's always that next level. And I guess what that is for right now is the professional entities that are bass fishing, and everyone kind of looks to what they're doing. And you look at the videos and all of this, it's that kind of tailors back to it. I'm not sure if that will change, but I'm sure it will, because it's where the money goes, right?
Yeah.
More money is going to be put into getting more people into the sport, which this year was record high for fishing licenses in the country with COVID, which is you know, great. We may see a change in that.
Yeah. It's something that's very interesting to me. I'm just going to keep watching it. I feel like you and I could probably talk forever. I would love to sit down. I'd love to be matching the drink that you're drinking right now instead of my coffee and have a really nice, like have a proper off the record discussion about a lot of things. But is there anything in particular that you would like to address while I've got you on here?
You know, I think that we've loosely kind of covered a lot of the interesting stuff, but like you said, yeah, I think that we could probably talk for entirely too long over a good old fashioned.
Before we wrap it up, is there anything that you would like to add or to ask me?
I do want to ask you something. If you could, if you have one species on your list, what would it be? I'm sure you've been asked this 1,000 times, but I think that, you know, like people have their drink and it kind of defines them. I think people have their one species that they just, that's the one thing they want to target all the time. And it kind of says a lot about who you are as an angler. So I'm curious what yours would be.
Like if I was going to die tomorrow and I had one more day.
Yep, one more day. So maybe not one that you've caught, you know, before that you've chased and loved, or maybe one that you haven't. If you were going to die tomorrow and you had one day to go target that species, what would it be?
Steelhead.
I thought that might be it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And it's so much more than, oh, they pull hard, they take hard. It's none of that. It's none of those.
It's the culture. It's all of it, right?
It's my history with them. As I get older, and you know, I could go down a whole long path on this, and I won't just because I don't feel like crying right now, but as my dog is going to die any day, right? Colby's not well. And
I'm sorry to hear that.
That's his life, right? He's 12 and he's a St. Bernard. So he was never supposed to live this long anyway, but
no,
but it's going to happen. And it really, I realized that when Colby's gone, that's it for my 20s. They're dead. They're gone. And as a mom, and you know, look, like I love my life and I love my daughter. I love my husband, all those things, you know, and I'm not just saying that to be, you know, to be like a good mom, but I love all that. But I don't want to forget the person I was in my early 20s. I love her. She was a mess, but I'm not ready to let her go yet. I want to remember her. I love who she made me. So steelhead are that one thing. Like when Colby's gone and my youth is gone and all those things are gone, I'll still have steelhead to remind me that that was who I was then. So for me, it's so much more than just what they are as a species. It's what they help me to remember about myself, if that makes sense.
Oh, you nailed that. That was great. Thank you.
Thanks. What about you? What would you fish for?
Muskie.
Why?
Again, not because they pull hard or because, you know, they're this elusive badass predator, but because I see a lot of who I am and what their reputation is. And it's the challenge. It's the chase. It is the giving everything you have and the suffering. It is all about the suffering and enduring to get to where you are with that. And I love it. I love hate it. You know, I love being out there and I love knowing that any moment could just be a life-changing deal. So
look, I'm going to really enjoy watching your career and your life and just you over the next decade. There are going to be some really awesome changes. And you're very intriguing. I'm here if you ever need me. And I hope that we can continue our conversation again.
Me too, April. It was an absolute pleasure.
And that concludes this episode of Anchored. Thank you for listening.
Hey everyone, Will Cooper here, host of Hunt Stand's Make Your Mark podcast. Join us as we dive deep into the world of hunting and outdoor pursuits. We've brought together some of the most accomplished individuals in the industry to share their invaluable insights and experiences with you. But here's the kicker. It's not just about hunting tips and tactics. We're exploring how you can carve your own path, elevate your skills, and gain some wisdom from the best in the field. So whether you're a seasoned hunter looking to fine-tune your skills or a newbie eager to learn, our podcast has something for everyone. Stay tuned for more exciting guests and hotter topics. Don't miss out and subscribe to Hunt Stand's Make Your Mark podcast today and start making your mark in the great outdoors.
Brave anglers search for the one they call king, but who will take his throne? Tune in to Waypoint TV's Battle for Silver, Saturday, May 18th from 12 to 6 p.m. Eastern, presented by Abyss Battery, Waypoint TV.